Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Looking at Lucasfilm, the podcast with a different perspective on the world of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and all of the other entities that George Lucas, Kathleen Kennedy, Dave Filoni, and Jon Favreau, as well as the rest of the team at Lucasfilm, have dreamed up over the past 40 years. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and my co-host Brian Gaughan and I are recording this week's show on Tuesday, June 27, 2023, just 3 days out from the theatrical release of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. And Brian, you are going Thursday afternoon, right?
Thursday afternoon. It's so funny. Remember when they would do a preview show and it was usually at midnight?
Yeah. Or the Saturday before.
Right. That was that was a sneak preview. Yeah. Those were fun.
Yeah, they were.
Because you saw two movies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. But then they started doing the midnight shows and I would go to a couple of those, mm-hmm. but I couldn't get my family to go. Mm-hmm. But now they start at 3 p.m. Yeah. out here. So we got tickets for all four of us in the reclining Dolby sound theater.
Oh,
so
wow.
I'm looking forward. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
Big films like this, I spend the money. I break open the piggy bank and, okay. you know, I have to see it that way.
I completely understand it. I mean, face it, it's been 8 years now since this project was first announced back in May of 2015. That's when Kathleen Kennedy revealed that there was a fifth Indiana Jones film in the works. Though George Lucas, right after Kingdom of the Crystal Skull came out in May of 2008, began noodling on an idea for a fifth indie film. And George reportedly shared this idea with Harrison Ford in the fall of that same year. So while Harrison Ford was out doing promotion for the Blu-ray DVD version of Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, that hit store shelves back on October 14th, 2008, Ford was quoted as saying, "George's idea for a fifth indie film was crazy, but great." Which leaves me, did any of that end up in Dial of Destiny? Or
well, if it was right away, it would have been like a sequel, right? So you might have had Mutt in it. You might have had Miriam in it. Maybe even Miriam's father. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just watched it again, mm-hmm. and it, well, of course, it opens wide open to a sequel. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Shia wasn't bad. He was pretty good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was a good addition. And it would have been great to see them play off each other. Mm-hmm. So have you heard anything, what that idea was?
To be honest, no. In fact, I was doing some poking this afternoon about that very same topic, because later on the show, folks, we're going to really do a deep dive into the history of Indiana Jones. We're going to be talking about the first gentleman who was initially cast in the role. But if we're going to go back to Kingdom of the Crystal Skull for a moment, kind of interesting that its opening weekend, I want to say it did, well, first of all, it was a 5-day opening weekend. I want to say it opened over Memorial Day weekend, so it was that sort of extendo weekend. And it did over $100 million. In fact, I think it might have crept up to close to $150 million over the 5-day weekend. I bring that up because the box office projections for Dial of Destiny are not in that neighborhood, Brian. In fact, right now, supposedly in North America, over its opening weekend in theaters, Indiana Jones 5 is projected to sell 60 to 65 million worth of tickets, with an additional 75 to 80 million overseas. So combined worldwide box office total for Dial of Destiny's opening weekend, 140 million.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. See, That's what I was talking about. Mm. People aren't going to the movies.
Yeah. Well, but here's the thing. Not entirely true. I mean, Super Mario Brothers, its opening weekend in North America, 146 million. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, 120 million. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, which you were just talking about going to and laughing and pointing out the stuff, 118 million. So, and even Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania back in February, 106. I mean, what?
Then why are they lowballing this?
Original Raiders had a runtime of an hour and 45 minutes. Dial of Destiny has a runtime of 2 hours and 22 minutes.
Okay.
So you know from your time of running a theater what that means. That means you cannot physically show that film as many times a day as you can an hour and 45-minute long film.
No, you lose at least one screening.
There we go. There we go. And so that's going to impact the box office potential for this thing. And what's interesting, that is the longest running time to date for, you know, in fact, Indiana Jones and the Temple of the Crystal Skull was 2 hours and 2 minutes long. That was the longest one up until that time. I stand corrected. Last Crusade was 2 hours and 7 minutes long.
Do you think this could be like the Spielberg factor? Because Spielberg is such a tight filmmaker that he knows what to put in a film and how to do it without just putting too much stuff in one bag, so to speak?
That's an interesting question because, I mean, think about it. Spielberg, he stepped away from this film in February of 2020. And when I say stepped away,
he was actually attached to it?
He was going to direct up until February of 2020. And he then assumed an executive producer role. And face it, James Mangold, you know, the director of this thing, has been working closely with Spielberg and Lucas on the project and Harrison Ford. I wonder how much of this, though, is the, you know, this is the last Harrison Ford Indiana Jones film. In fact, you and I were at D23 in Hall D23 when he stood on stage and said, "This is the last time I'm falling down for you people."
For you people, yeah.
But at the same time, what's kind of interesting is Bob Iger on the red carpet at Cannes last month said to the press there, "This is not the end of this franchise," which that's a man who's looking at what they paid to make this movie, which is reportedly $295 million, Brian. So This is a guy who like, yeah, we're making more indie movies, you know, but how? Well, I'll tell you what, we'll get to the how in a moment. We'll have more news in a sec. But first, want to remind you that the news portion of Looking at Lucasfilm is brought to you by Storybook Destination, trusted travel partner of the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network, for a worry-free travel experience every time. Please book online at storybookdestinations.com. Okay, again, a little more Dial of Destiny news here before we move on to other topics. And again, we were just mentioning Bob Iger's comments about, you know, the future of the Indiana Jones franchise.
Wait, but did he say this before they started, like, pulling things from Disney Plus and canceling things?
I want to say yes.
Okay, because, yeah, I heard, I mean, the people were going, oh, great, we're going to have an indie series, or maybe Phoebe Waller is going to be, you know, the next Indiana, or they'll grab somebody else, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, but then, that is interesting you say that, because yes, wasn't there a rumor out there about an Abner Ravenwood
limited series?
Hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And then there was also, I think I heard something that said, it may have been Kennedy said, we're going to focus on Star Wars now. Mm-hmm. And then they canceled anything to do with Willow and even took Willow off Disney Plus. And they didn't say anything about Indy, but they kind of didn't say anything for Indy either. So,
all right, let me share what James Mangold, because again, there's a rumor making the rounds that the Helena Shaw character, that's the character that Phoebe Waller-Bridge plays in Dial of Destiny, who is supposed to be Indiana Jones's goddaughter. There was some talk, I guess, initially, or at least rumors out there on the internet, that this is what Disney wanted to do. The goddaughter effectively would take on the mantle of the rogue, you know, explorer. James Mangold, when he got asked, about, well, okay, would you direct Indy 6 if they made one of these around the Helena Shaw character? And he, it's one of those things where it's like, wow, tell us how you really think. Again, he said, I'm not interested. I refuse. I just can't do it. The amount of lore and Easter eggs and fan service starts to become antithetical to any of this stuff at a certain point. It isn't storytelling anymore. It's large-scale advertising. And by the way, talking about large-scale advertising, did you see we're starting this Friday, June 30th, there's going to be an Indiana Jones walk-around character appearing at Adventureland at Disneyland Park in Anaheim doing meet-and-greets?
I heard the rumor of it. Is he going to be outside Jungle Cruise and Temple of Doom or whatever it's called?
I do not know. I know this is supposedly a limited-time offering, and so, again, I'm just throwing this out here to any looking at Lucasfilm, you know, listeners who are headed to the Disneyland sometime over the next week to 10 days.
All right, I'll try to go to Disneyland.
Oh, yeah, you'll throw yourself on that grenade. You know, wow, you will make that sacrifice. Okay. Well, all right. I'll appeal to the folks who are headed that way anyway this summer. Because what fascinates me about this, in fact, Len and I talked about this on Disney Dish when they did that back in 2008 when Disneyland sort of teamed up with Lucasfilm to promote Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And they had Indiana Jones and the Secret of the Tiger Temple or something. In fact, they staged in
the old... where the old Tahitian Terrace.
Yeah, which got retooled into the Aladdin's Bazaar Cafe. I'm blanking the name here, but
see, I remember all of those. I remember the first one. I remember the Fire Eaters. I remember the Aladdin one. But I don't know why. Maybe because it wasn't on my. I saw the movie and everything, but I didn't go. I don't know why I didn't go to Disneyland at this time and see that. But I didn't. I didn't know anything about it. It sounds like it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And something different.
The thing that's kind of intriguing about what they did then, remember, this is when Lucasfilm still owned Indy outright and Star Wars and the like. And one of the terms and conditions they made for bringing this into the park for that summer was Indy couldn't pose for photos. Indy couldn't sign autographs. He couldn't do meet and greets. And for a lot of little kids who'd come to see the show, you know, the fact that Indy, well, I gotta go, kid, and, you know, run out of the theater, and then he'd, like, do stunt show stuff on the rooftops of Adventureland, but he wouldn't come down and interact with the guests. That really became a sore point with families visiting the park. It's like, look, you know, my kid gets to hang out with Mickey, but not Indy?
Yeah. Was that for the stunt show in Florida, too, that they didn't have any meet and greets there either?
It's a very interesting question. I will have to check on that.
Okay, because it just seems, because I remember every film that was ever released, there would be some kind of walk around. I mean, I remember Tarzan. That was the best. Mm. The guy who played Tarzan was just amazing. Mm. And like every film that came out, live action or animation, there was a walk around. Mainly, you know, there were like Tarzan, he was a face character. Mm-hmm. Is that what it's called? A face?
Well, typically a Disney princess or, you know, their boyfriend or that sort of thing. Again, you know, the characters, you know, the rubber heads. You know, but again, I don't think they've called them those since the 60s. All right. Somebody who works in the zoo crew. And I'm probably dating myself also there because that's what they used to call the folks who did the characters in the park back in the 90s, the zoo crew. If somebody wants to get us, get us the proper terminology, that would be great. Anyway, circling back now to Mr. Mangold, who he does not sound happy with the internet, particularly those folks who have been criticizing Dial of Destiny before frame one.
Without their even seeing it.
Well, and what are the point before?
Which blows my mind.
It went before the cameras.
Oh, really? That far back?
Well, this is the interview that Mangold did with IO9, and he's quoted as saying, early on, there were some people who were knocking the picture before I had even started shooting it. And I thought, probably stupidly, because there's no way to have a kind of fair dialogue in these forums. I thought if I just pointed out that, why did you let me make it before you rip it apart? That it would actually engender some sort of human response. But the problem is it doesn't. And what was mystifying for me for a couple of months was you'd be reading these things about your movie that were not just wholly untrue, but were completely made up. And the way the echo chamber of the internet works is if one person says it and then says, I heard a rumor, you can then report that I read a report. And then you've got a more legitimate institution and someone can go, well, I read on Gizmoid a report of a rumor. And then suddenly this whole thing starts to have a life of its own and you're battling it and it's complete fiction. There's an idealist in me and I keep going. If I just tell people the truth, won't they believe me? And then I realize, no. The whole world that views me as a part of some elite conspiratorial effort to undermine something. And I'm not. I'm just a guy who loves movies, who's trying to live through each day and do the best I can, knowing that I can't possibly please everyone. And it's like, oh, man, I've been working this side of the street since, dear Lord, 1998. And so that's 25 years on the web. Woof. And look, Mr. Mangold is not wrong. It is fascinating how something completely outrageous and totally untrue can get said in one corner of the internet. And then someone else will share that rumor, which somehow makes this completely false piece of gossip seem legit.
Well, it's those YouTube guys, too, that they want as many eyeballs on them as possible. And I guess, I think you and I were talking about this, or I was talking about my friend. Negativity is more of raw meat than positivity.
You're not wrong. And also,
and people just like to make up things. I mean, here's Kathleen Kennedy getting an extension, three-year extension to go on and do what I think she's been doing a great job. And they spin it to make it a conspiracy. And it's like, oh my gosh, am I just not? And then I try to talk to my kids about it. And they tell me that it's a generational thing.
For me, what's fascinating, and in fact, we went to Nancy's 50th high school reunion just this past weekend.
Oh, wow.
And I got to interact with some of her classmates. And we won't get into specifics here, but there was one person in general who, you know, those people who live to be outraged, who are sort of seeking something to be offended by. She has a classmate who does that. Every conversation sort of steered to something that, you know, I could have literally picked up my phone and hit Google at the, well, that's not true. It's like, no, I can show you. That's not true. But why let the truth stand in the way of a good story? So eventually I just sort of disengage, you know, back away.
Well, you had a lot of self-control to do that because I can't do that. I bring out the Google and I'm just going, well, what is this? I mean, I had somebody tell me that vitamins will cause memory loss. And I said, well, send me the article. They sent me the article and it said the complete opposite. That vitamins, a daily vitamin actually helps stop memory loss. So it's like,
it's at that moment, it's like, well, is there a vitamin out there for reading comprehension? Maybe you should take that.
A Focus Adderall.
There we go. There we go. All right. Now, speaking of trying to deal with, false info on the internet, Lucasfilm actually trying. Star Wars Celebration in London back in April, Kathleen Kennedy revealed that there are three Star Wars films being readied for theatrical release. They're, Project Interactive Development.
But they were not the same three that were announced 8 months earlier.
A lady is allowed to change her mind. You've been a husband long enough. You should know this.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's right.
All right. So anyway, one of these films is supposed to continue the storyline of Rey Skywalker, the character that Daisy Ridley played in the most recent Disney-produced Star Wars trilogy. And all we really know at this point about this new Ray movie is Charmaine Obaid Shenoy. She's a 45-year-old Pakistani-Canadian filmmaker who's already won 2 Oscars for her work in the documentary shorts category. She's been tapped to supposedly direct this project. Now, mind you, that didn't stop Production Weekly from posting a brief story synopsis. The film reportedly follows Rey as she rebuilds the Jedi Order and works with 2 young students who've shown a tremendous gift when it comes to the Force, not to mention we supposedly have a name for the film, Star Wars New Jedi Order.
Oh, really?
And even a supposed start date for this production, which is April of next year. Now, after this info was posted on Production Weekly, Lucasfilm took the unusual move of reaching out to Gizmoid, which shared this info with its readers through IO9, to state on the record that, for starters, story synopsis isn't accurate. Film's title is a placeholder and likely to change further on down the line.
Oh.
And, you know, go further. Rey will be featured in the film, but may not be the lead character. And finally,
okay,
the film's proposed start date, as mentioned in the Production Weekly listing, is currently correct. But that said, due to the ongoing writer striking, is likely to be pushed back. And I mean, I love that Lucas is out there trying to correct this info, but at the same time, this part is all wrong, that part's partially true, this part's true, but likely to change. I don't know if that's going to do more harm than good here.
Does Lucasfilm or Disney have, maybe this is something they should think about. Mm-hmm. A lot of this information is put out, especially on YouTube, about, mm-hmm. you know, by these guys who, mm-hmm. you know, they feel that they own Star Wars themselves or anything like that. Could we get somebody to, you know, put out a magazine, you know, or do something that would basically just like, okay, here's a rumor, here's the truth, here's a rumor, here's the truth, here's what we want to do, here's what we were going to do, but we changed it to this and things like that. I mean, you mentioned about the director. Yeah. I mean, yes, she's won a couple Academy Awards, mm-hmm. but she made one of the best Disney Plus mm-hmm. series of Marvel Girl.
No. Okay.
She directed that mm-hmm. too, which was like amazing, especially the part about mm-hmm. the separation of India and Pakistan, mm-hmm. which I did not know. Mm-hmm. It was
God.
Like that.
Yes, that episode of Ms. Marvel. My God,
yeah,
you are correct.
Ms. Marvel. Okay, not Marvel, my mistake. Ms. Marvel.
Okay.
And then another thing is, like, she was originally going to be directing the Damien Lindelof mm-hmm. script. And then they took him off of it, mm-hmm. but they kept everybody else on it, not the writer, but mm-hmm. everybody else. So do you think there are going to be some elements of Lindelof? I know Lindelof said, you know, they're not crazy about this at this time, mm-hmm. but I'm still going to do, you know, keep on doing it because I love Star Wars and I want to be a part of this.
I have sort of pivoted in the way I view Star Wars. These days, I'm perfectly happy to sit at home and watch. In fact, for example, we have Ahsoka, you know, Star Wars Ahsoka, you know, debuting, Wednesday, August 23rd. In fact, this coming weekend, down at the Essence Festival of Culture, which is being held in New Orleans, June 29th through July 3rd, Disney is actually presenting 3 panels on Saturday and Sunday. They've got a panel about their new Haunted Mansion movie, which looks surprisingly good. I'm kind of surprised at how much I want to see that. Likewise, they're going to have a panel on Disney's Wish, which Drew just talked up about what he saw.
Drew said about it, mm-hmm. it made me, at first I wasn't crazy about it. Mm-hmm. I can't wait to see this film now.
It's one of these things where it's like, okay, that sounds interesting. You know, all right, I'll be there on November 22nd. Take my money.
Yeah, now.
But also, they're going to have a panel on Ahsoka. And did you see Dave Filoni's most recent comments on Star Wars Ahsoka? It's basically going to be season 5?
5 of Star Wars Rebels. Yeah. I mean, because that's the way it ended. It ended right at the... But then, mm-hmm. but see... Ahsoka wasn't the main character to, you know, to want to go after Ezra. Mm-hmm. It was Sabine. Is that her name?
Well, yeah, Sabine Wren.
Yeah, Sabine wanted to go, and then Ahsoka said, okay, I'll go with you. Mm-hmm. I mean, wasn't it? And now it's going to be, okay, I'm getting too excited.
Okay,
here.
Well, to explain what Brian is enthusing about, for those of you who did not see Farewell, the last episode of season 4 of Star Wars Rebels, we saw a pod of Purgles, those space-going whale creatures that live in hyperspace, who were following sort of Ezra Bridger's lead. And didn't they take Ezra and Grand
General Thrawn,
Admiral Thrawn, off to parts unknown in hyperspace? So we don't. In fact, that's as the show is ending. We've jumped ahead 5 years. It's after the Battle of Endor, and we see Sabine Wren, the Mandalorian graffiti artist and bomb maker, teaming up with Ahsoka, and in fact, we see her working in a mural of everybody from Star Wars Rebels, but then they climb into a
painting.
Didn't they basically say they're it's time to bring Ezra home, right? So that they head off.
But then in The Mandalorian, mm-hmm. you notice how she's going around asking where Thrawn is, not where Ezra is, but where Thrawn is.
Now, it's interesting you bring that up, because the official log line for Star Wars Ahsoka is, set after the fall of the Empire, Star Wars Ahsoka follows the former Jedi Knight Ahsoka Tana as she investigates an emerging threat to a vulnerable galaxy, which, reading between the lines here, and also from that image from the back of his head, gotta be Grand Admiral Thrawn. You know, and what are the point? What was it? That episode in season 3 of Mandalorian where Ahsoka flat out asks the woman she's doing battle with, where is Thrawn?
Is Thrawn, yeah. Right.
So, okay.
Who I hear is also going to be in the Ahsoka series, that person she fought.
Oh, I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, I think I read that, or I saw, or maybe it's going to be a flashback or something.
Okay, all right. So, yeah, so Thrawn, and more to the point, we did see, just in this past season, a lot of people talking about Thrawn, all of that. So it's like the stage is clearly set. And so, again, looking forward to what Dave Filoni's, you know, doing here, and how, you know, all these shoes that have been waiting to drop for a long, long time are finally dropping. And speaking of wardrobe-related things and a long, long time, did you see the story about Princess Leia's dress?
Oh, no, I didn't hear this one. Are they selling it
or
something?
Well, no. Okay, the dress we're talking about is the one that Princess Leia wore in the medal ceremony at the very end of the original Star Wars movie. It has been missing for 47 years, thought to be lost forever, only to recently be discovered in an attic in London that was once owned by a New Hope crew member. So, to be specific, this dress, which was designed by Academy Award-winning costume designer John Molo, he actually took home the Academy Award that year for his work in the original Star Wars. This was the 1978 Academy Awards. It's described as being cream, lightweight, silk fabric, and involving intricate draping, which for two guys like us who eat far too many tacos, you know, just the dry cleaning bills alone.
I know, but the significant others may be okay in it.
That's an interesting point. Okay.
I want to say one more thing about Ahsoka, though.
Okay.
About this whole, did you read science fiction when you were a kid? Asimov? Did you read any of the Asimov stuff?
We're skating on thin ice. I mean, I come from a family of great science fiction readers. My dad, my brother Peter, you know, Frank Herbert, Asimov. No, I was the guy who I couldn't even do The Hobbit. All right, which I know is a fantasy, but again, I couldn't do the Dune books. I lack the science fiction gene. On the other hand,
I
love Star
do
Trek,
too,
love Star Wars,
I love detective stories.
Okay,
and when Asimov wrote the Oliver detective stories about the robot detective in Caves of Steel and etc. He wrote three basic series. He wrote Empire. He wrote Foundation. Mm-hmm. And he wrote the Detective series. What he did is when he was done with those series, he then wrote books that connected these series. Mm-hmm. So Empire was, or actually the Detectives were first, that went into Empire, that went into Foundation. Mm-hmm. And I see Filoni mm-hmm. and Favreau and the rest of them doing the same thing. They're taking these little aspects of Star Wars and they're putting them together with the Bad Batch, with the Jedi mm-hmm. stories, mm-hmm. and also with Ahsoka and Mandalorian. And what they're doing is they're filling in the pieces mm-hmm. to make them a whole and to connect them. And that's, you know, this is... I think Ahsoka is going to really tie a lot of things together, and then the movie that he's going to do afterwards will tie into probably the new order, et cetera.
What I've been hearing about the Filoni film project, and again, I was just complaining about people passing, you know, rumors off as,
yeah.
you know, hard fact. What friends at Lucasfilm have been sharing with me is basically it said, look, what Dave's attempting to do with his film is basically it's going to be the Avengers of Star Wars. It's going to take all of the characters that you love and bring them together in one film. Now, mind you, you know, when we say all the characters that you love, we're talking a lot of the characters you've been introduced to from the limited series. And them all coming together for one grand adventure, upping the scale of the storytelling. But again, that's all I have, the basic concept. I have no story threads. I have no titles. I have no casting. I have the concept. And even then, subject to change. So.
Oh, yeah. But it's still as exciting to hear something like that because, like I said, it's going to wrap everything together.
And speaking of wraps, we have to get back to the dress here for a moment. Okay, so that dress over the past 8 months has been lovingly restored by hand. And over the next 3 days, folks, we're talking June 28th through the 30th, it will be one of the items auctioned off by the prop store. They are doing a Star Wars memorabilia auction live out in L.A. Over the next 3 days. And if you want to eyeball some of the items that will be coming up for bid, head to the Prop Store's website, which can be found at propstoreauction.com, all one word. By the way, just in case you're wondering how much that dress from the award ceremony at the end of New Hope.
$3,000.
Several more zeros. Try $2 million.
Oh, my goodness.
So
I wonder how much the bikini would go for. Of course, there's not a lot of material in it, so it's got to go for half price.
Okay, we are treading on such thin ice here.
Is it time for a break?
It's time for a break. When Brian and I get back, we will use the recent cancellation of a TV remake as an excuse to talk about who almost got to play Indiana Jones back in 1980. Did you see the news last week that NBC was canceling the Magnum P.I. remake?
Yeah, I think it's because CBS is doing Matlock. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, no. It's interesting you bring up CBS because, again, CBS is where the original Magnum P.I. series debuted back in December of 1980, ran for 8 seasons. But that was also the place that initially did the remake of Magnum P.I. I want to say that it ran for 4 seasons there. Got canceled last year, and NBC picked it up for one more season. And here we are. We bring this up tonight, folks, because out ahead of the theatrical release of Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, if CBS executives had been a little more flexible back in 1980, the star of the original version of Magnum P.I., Tom Selleck, would have played the lead in Raiders of the Lost Ark, which was released to theaters back on June 12th, 1981. And this is kind of the part of the story that the folks at Lucasfilm really like to sort of step around and smooth over, you know, because it's like, you know, the whole notion that Harrison Ford wasn't George Lucas's first choice to play Dr. Jones. Now, mind you, supposedly Steven Spielberg, right from the get-go, pushed for Harrison Ford to play this part. And as the story goes, Lucas showed Spielberg a work-in-progress cut of Empire. And he's like, oh, Ford is great. You know, and they had been developing Indy for quite a while at that point, and let's get Harrison. But Lucas was resistant, and not for any reason. I mean, Ford had been his usual nose-and-nonsense, low-drama guy on the set of Empire, and George had worked with him for years. I mean, ever since American Graffiti.
Yeah, but even after American Graffiti, he wasn't sure to have Harrison in the original Star Wars. I mean, Christopher Walken was up for
an
Al Pacino.
He was. This is all true. This is all true. And in fact,
so I can see why he would just think, well, you know what? He makes a good cabinet. So, you know.
Yes, he did. In fact, no, that brings to mind that supposedly that, you know, how many of the people who came in for Leia and Luke wound up reading sides with Harrison Ford, because he was in the office building bookshelves for George Lucas.
Building bookshelves, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was like, and he, you know, that was the thing. Eventually, it was like, you know, I keep hearing Harrison's voice in my head, and it's like, well, you keep having him read with other people, and that's how he wound up with Han Solo. But we're talking about Raiders now, and what's interesting is Mike Fighton, the casting director for Raiders, initially brought in anyone in Hollywood back in the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, and the list is just kind of stunning. I mean, it's like Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Jack Nicholson, oh, wow, Peter Coyote, Nick Nolte, Sam Elliott, Tim Matheson, and Harry Hamlin.
Peter Coyote would have probably been really good.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, any of them could, I mean, especially under Spielberg's direction, anybody could have taken it and made it, but there was just something about Harrison. He was just so natural.
Now, but before we get ahead of ourselves here,
okay.
Now, remember, this is a work in progress. In fact, Lawrence Kasdan, when he was hired to do the script for Indy, he said what was fascinating is that George and Steven had these set pieces that they wanted in the movie.
Okay.
And they had their MacGuffin, they had their Ark of the Covenant, but it was Kasdan's job to create the connective tissue. So the early iteration of the script, in fact, I've got a copy of the original Kasdan script for it, and what's fascinating is the scenes that, for a lot of people, take them out of Temple of Doom, because they're kind of too jokey, they're too silly.
Right, like the eating of the bugs and stuff.
Well,
like that.
There's three scenes to be specific. There's the scene at the nightclub in Shanghai with the dancing girls and the gong. There's the scene where the plane, the pilots have jumped out, and the way that Indiana Jones and Teddy, I'm blanking the name of, the way they survive is they throw the inflatable raft out and it lands on the mountainside and they slide down. And then there's the mine chase that looked like a Disney theme park attraction.
This was a sequel to 1941.
Oh, you see, now this is what happens.
This was taking the idea of making it's a mad world and putting into Indiana Jones.
Well, I, you know,
am I wrong?
No, I mean, well, here's the thing. I mean, think about it. The original Star Wars is obviously an homage, a tribute to Buck Rogers and
samurai films.
But again, the movie serials of the 30s. So the notion was when Spielberg and Lucas were working on the original indie movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the thinking was, you know, are we going back to the well once too often? You know, if we're doing another homage to movie serials, shouldn't there be another element here? Maybe we could do a spoof. So these bigger, funnier, over-the-top scenes. And again, you're not wrong about the 1941 thing, is that Spielberg, while they're developing this, is directing 1941 and is really getting a taste for these big, over-the-top action set pieces. But then, of course, when that comes out in December of 79, and doesn't do particularly well at the stateside's box office, Spielberg hits a reset button and it's like, okay, we're going to be serious, we're going to be sincere. And so the notion of bringing in a Chevy Chase or a Bill Murray or...
Okay, so that's why the first list was basically comic heavy, because they were going to make a funny version of the serials.
Well, now this is where it gets interesting. Okay, so they do all the readings and it now comes down to two choices. One of which is Jeff Bridges. And the other is Tom Selleck. Now, Mike Fighton is heavily pushing for Jeff Bridges, who's obviously not an unknown at this point. I mean, you know, did...
King Kong.
King Kong. Also did Thunderbolt and Lightfoot with Clint Eastwood.
Right.
So what Fighton likes about Bridges is Jeff is just coming off of Heaven's Gate. Which nowadays, because we can see the original Michael Cimino cut of that film rather than the one that the studio shoved down his throat, now that's very admired. But back in, you know, 1980s or thereabouts, right, that Michael Cimino film was considered the height of Hollywood excess. You know, it cost $44 million to make, only makes $3.5 million in ticket sales. And so post Heaven's Gate, Jeff Bridges is now looking for something commercial. And the idea of playing the lead in a film directed by Steven Spielberg, you know, the Jaws and Close Encounter guy, and produced by George Lucas, Mr. Star Wars, very, very appealing to Mr. Bridges.
Oh, yeah.
Bridges was even willing to sign a contract that would have roped him into playing Indiana Jones, not only in Raiders, but for two yet-to-be-written sequels. And better yet, this is what Fighton is selling to Spielberg. It's like, because Heaven's Gate has dinged Jeff Bridges' box office, he's now willing to sign on to do the first indie at well below his usual quote. So you're going to get a name star in Raiders for a bargain. Now, mind you, to sort of sweeten the deal, there would have been language in Bridges' deal to the effect of, look, if the Raiders makes money, we will, of course, revisit the salary situation for the two sequels and yada, yada. So this seemed like a solid plan for Raiders, a known movie star in that film's lead role for a bargain price. But standing in Mike Fighton's way is Marcia Lucas, George Lucas's then wife. Marcia and George wouldn't divorce for another 3 years yet. The split wouldn't become official until June of 83 after Return of the Jedi came out. But even though Tom Selleck's acting resume at this time is mostly working for television, appearances on TV series like The Rockford Files or in miniseries like The Sacketts, Marcia Lucas really liked how Tom Selleck looked in his Indiana Jones audition. You know, he kept telling George, this guy's going to be a star someday. You should cast him.
Are there any pictures out there of him wearing the Indiana Jones garb?
I know they comped together some posters, and he literally looks like he stepped out of... Was it Ralph McQuarrie that did the four production paintings that they used?
For Indiana Jones? Yeah, I think so.
Okay, good.
Now, did he have the mustache?
I want to say yes.
Okay.
Okay, but anyway, all right, so... Anyway, getting back to Marcia Lucas. Given that Marcia's advice to George, when he was making American Graffiti, as well as the original Star Wars, as well as its first sequel, Empire, had proved to be invaluable. I mean, Marcia, Marcia, brilliant storyteller and a world-class editor in her own right. George heeded Marcia's advice and persuaded Steven that, look, maybe we should cast this relative unknown, Tom Selleck, is Dr. Jones over the clearly much better known Jeff Bridges. And now don't feel bad for Jeff Bridges. Okay, so he loses out on playing the lead in Raiders of the Lost Ark, but he almost immediately accepts a role in the very next high-profile, sure-to-be commercial project that comes his way, which turns out to be Disney's very first Tron, which took a while to get to the screens because, you know, obviously all the effects work. That was July 9th, 1982. But back to Tom Selleck now. Given the way showbiz works, Selleck goes from being the guy who guest stars on The Fall Guy and Taxi to overnight becoming the guy who, because he's just signed with this new Spielberg film, gets his, you know, he's made six pilots that have not been picked up. But now, because, he's going to be making the Spielberg movie, CBS picks up his next pilot, which is for Magnum PI. For the first season of any TV show, it's traditionally the network, not the production company, which in this case was Glenn A. Larson Productions, the company behind Battlestar Galactica and Knight Rider, or the studio where this show was being shot, which in this case was Universal Television. But it's the network that has all of the power. And this time around, the network is CBS. And when it came to the first season of Magnum PI, CBS had a deal with Glenn A. Larson Productions and Universal Television that the talent, which had been contracted to appear in this new action drama, would be available for the production of at least 13 episodes, with an option to then move forward with an additional 9 episodes. And what's the turn of phrase they use here? The back nine, right? Like the back nine holes of a golf course.
Yeah, if they do well, I mean, then they can... They'll put up the back nine, and they'll have a complete 22-episode season. If it doesn't do well, or what they think is well, they will then cancel it, and then they didn't spend a lot of money.
There we go. All right, now, rumors had begun to spread around town that Tom Selleck was up for the lead in this new film that Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were about to make for Paramount. And so CBS preemptively signs Tom to do Magnum PI. So that's the first contract. And then Spielberg and Lucas actually do sign Selleck to appear in Raiders. But Raiders has a locked-in release date of June 12, 1981, which means in order to finish the film in time, this thing has to be before the cameras no later than June 23rd, 1980. Basically 50 weeks to get the film shot, edited through effects work, scored into theaters. But production of the first season of Magnum PI is supposed to run through the first week of July of that same year, 1980. So in order for Tom Selleck to play Indiana Jones in Raiders, he's going to need to be completely done with working on Magnum PI by June 22nd, 1980, absolute latest. I mean, literally, finish on the 22nd on Magnum, pick up doing Raiders the very next day. But again, everybody has to agree to this. So first, Spielberg and Lucas go to Glenn A. Larson Production and ask if Selleck can be sprung for Magnum PI's his obligations there on June 22nd. And they say yes. And then Steven and George go to Universal Television and ask for their help in getting Tom cleared to start work on Raiders. And again, this is Universal. This is where Steve made Jaws. It's like, of course. Right. Of course, Mr. Spielberg. Absolutely. And by the way, can we talk to you about another Jaws movie? So now Spielberg and Lucas go to CBS. And instead of the quick yeses that they got from officials at Glenn A. Larson and Universal Television, it takes the suits at the Tiffany Network weeks to say, eventually back to Spielberg said, no, we can't release Tom Selleck early to work on Raiders because, all right, here's the thing, Brian. I've never really been able to get a straight answer as to why CBS dug in their heels, why they wouldn't agree to release Selleck early out of Magnum PI. That said, it is worth noting that the Star Wars Holiday Special did air on CBS in November of 1978. And given that George Lucas wasn't exactly shy about talking about how badly he thought this two-hour-long presentation had turned out, and in fact, George was really quite vocal about all of these sitcom stars like Harvey Korman that they foisted onto the show. And so what I've heard over the years is that CBS preventing Tom Selleck from appearing in Raiders might have been a little bit of payback for what George said publicly about the Star Wars Holiday Special, which the thinking was at CBS, they spent all that money. They wanted something they could air every year, and it only aired that one time.
I don't know. That just seems too petty. Well, yeah, I know.
Welcome to show business, pal.
What am I saying? What am I saying? You know, if you give a somebody the wrong coffee with too many sugars in it, you know, you're off.
You're out of the industry.
Nowhere land.
There we go.
Yeah, so it doesn't But it doesn't. It still doesn't make sense to do that to.
No doubt.
I mean, but Tom Selleck didn't do anything wrong.
No, this would have just made
he would have gone back to Magnum PI, and this just would have made his Q rating even better.
No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. But to get back to the problem at hand, okay, they hand out this decision. It's literally weeks before production of Raiders is supposed to get underway. And this is when Spielberg and Lucas learn they've just lost their star. CBS flat out refusing to release Tom Selleck. So they now have to find somebody to play Indy and Fast.
And Harrison Ford was making shelves in Spielberg's office. And he goes, wait a minute.
Now, we'll get to Mr. Ford in a moment, but I want to point out the supreme irony here, especially on the heels of what's going on right now out in L.A. with the Writers Guild strike. Back in 1980, summer of 1980, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists goes on strike, which then disrupted production of Magnum P.I. And because this job action lasted till October 23rd of that same year, this means that Tom Selleck could have actually been free to shoot Raiders because production of season one of his TV show was halted. And in fact, you mentioned, you know, the whole notion of the 13 episodes, right, the back nine, 22 episodes. First season of Magnum PI, only 18 episodes because, again, production got disrupted by this job action. And now, mind you, nobody in the late spring, early summer of 1980 knew this job action was going to happen. All that George Lucas and Steven Spielberg now knew is they needed a new lead actor for Raiders. And by the way, circling back to Jeff Bridges is no longer an option because, as I mentioned, Jeff has agreed to do Tron at Disney. And in the interim, he's now shooting Cutter's Way for MGM UA. So this is when Spielberg turns to Lucas and says, call Harrison Ford now.
Yes, I need some shelves.
You know, well, no, that's exactly. And to Steven and George's great relief, they offer him the part of Indiana Jones, you know, with the understanding that the film would begin shooting in 4 weeks' time.
Oh, my goodness.
And Harrison almost...
He had to get in shape
in 4 weeks? I think if you look at, I mean, half the charm for me
was he was a professor.
Well, no, that's it exactly. And, you know, the whole... When he got beaten up in that movie, he looked like he was really getting beaten up. So let's get to that almost immediate yes. Empire Strikes Back wouldn't be released to theaters till May 21st, 1980. So that's a couple of weeks ahead here. And no one knew at that time that the sequel to the original Star Wars would earn over $500 million at the worldwide box office. By the way, that's just roughly two-thirds of what A New Hope did back in 77. The four films that Harrison shot right after A New Hope and prior to Empire Strikes Back, we're talking Heroes, Forrest 10 from Navarone, Hanover Street, and The Frisco Kid, had all underperformed at the box office.
Yeah, it was funny. I remember I saw all those films in the theater because of Harrison Ford, but none of them did well. And so his Q rating was going down.
There we go.
But then Empire came out, and then all of a sudden, but then another thing with the Star Wars movies, he was never happy with that character. And he would always say how, you know, he didn't want to be typecast. And that's why he did all these other films that were so far away from Han Solo. But if you think about it, Indy has a lot of Han Solo in him.
He does. He does. But to circle back to your comment about the cabinet maker, the shelf maker, this is a guy who approached Hollywood in a very realistic fashion. And look, you know, four films in a row not making money. And it's like, I need some job security, you know, and just the whole notion of here are these two guys, you know, it's George Lucas, I've worked with him, it's Steven Spielberg, you know, and they're offering me a role that, you know, in a film that's supposed to have two sequels. It's like, that's a very sweet gig after, you know, a little bit of safety and security after a few years of stumbles there. And also, don't feel bad for Tom Selleck. The original Magnum P.I., proved to be a long-running hit over at CBS, and to smooth over any bad feelings about the loss of Raiders of the Lost Ark, Selleck was allowed to create his own production company, TWS Productions, which stands for Thomas William Selleck Productions. And then got cut into some of that sweet, sweet Magnum PI, you know.
Did he get a back end deal?
Yeah, on it? Well, after the fact.
Because you hear things about, like, Angela Lansbury, how she did all these shows and she never had a piece of the show. And so she ended up with nothing at the end of it. But see, Tom was smart enough, or maybe they felt guilty enough.
I think that there was, you know, especially when Raiders became Raiders, and it was just like, oh.
Right.
Also, it's important to point out here that while Magni PI was on a hiatus following its second year of production, Selleck flew off to Yugoslavia, where he then shot his own Indiana Jones-esque film for theatrical release.
The High Road to China.
Which, by the way, did you see the title that it was released under overseas?
No, I didn't.
Oh, God. Do you want to talk about salt in the wounds? Seriously, this is the title for overseas. Raiders of the End of the World. So Warner's releases High Road to China stateside on March 18th, 1983. It doesn't do all that great. It takes in $28 million in ticket sales, costs $15 to make, so not great.
But it did show that he would have done a really great job as Indiana Jones.
This is true. And over the past 20 years or so, there has been some talk about trying to set things right, trying to find a way to officially fold Tom Selleck into the world of Indiana Jones. In fact, in between Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, when that was released in May of 1989, and when Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was released in May of 2008, there were a number of ideas for sequels tossed around. And I know of at least one treatment for a fourth Indiana Jones film that was written to pair up Harrison Ford and Tom Selleck with the idea that Selleck was supposed to have played Ford's brother.
Wait a minute.
I'm just telling you.
Then they're throwing away all the canon of young Indiana Jones.
And I get that. And remember, this is just a treatment. This is not a script per se. But I have no idea which state Indiana Jones's brother, Wisconsin Jones, I don't know.
That's true, because when the mother died, Indiana went on his own and didn't talk to his father, so it's very possible that his father had a family. Okay, that would have been pretty cool. I would have loved to have seen the two of them be adversaries, so to speak.
The problem is I have seen the log line on this, and I have been chasing this treatment for 15, 20 years at this point. I mean, I've got copies of three, maybe four, of the Indiana Jones films that were scripted but not shot. But it's one of these things where it's like, that one. I want to at least read the breakdown. And before we close here tonight, folks, given that we, you know, obviously, you know, Lucasfilm was owned by Disney, we should mention how Magnum P.I. actually impacted the Journey into Imagination Pavilion at Epcot. Have you heard this story?
No, I have not heard. How can Magnum P.I. be part of Journey to Imagination?
Okay.
What was Figment a sidekick or something? Figment was Higgins.
You are so close. You are so close.
Oh, really?
Okay. All right. It's October of 1981. And Tony Baxter, the lead creative on the Journey into Imagination Pavilion at Walt Disney World. I mean, we are now like 18 months out from it opening, and Tony has a problem. He knows that the Dreamfinder, the host of the Journey into Imagination Pavilion, has a small purple dragon for a pet sidekick, but Tony doesn't know what this character's name is yet. He's mulling this over, but he's at home, so he turns on his television. And what's on CBS that night? It's an episode of that brand new hit show, Magnum P.I. And on this particular episode, Magnum has snuck a goat onto the grounds of Robin Master's lavish estate in Hawaii, which, of course, upsets Higgins, the caretaker of Master's estate. And that role was
Magnum.
Yeah, John Hillerman did a wonderful job. You know,
he was just so great.
Great fun. Great fun. But something is eating the rare tropical flowers in the gardens at the Master's estate. And so Higgins calls Magnum on the carpet And Magnum's trying to play it off. He's like, no, 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 you're imagining things. There's nothing out there eating, you know. Like, and Higgins's response is, don't tell me this creature is a figment of my imagination. Figments don't eat rare tropical flowers. And Tony Baxter sits up on the couch at home. It's like, Figment, the name of the dragon is Figment.
That's hilarious.
Now, folks, if you want to actually watch this episode and see that moment, it's, I want to say the name of the episode is Dead Man's Channel. It's season 2, episode 2. But yeah, you can actually see the moment that inspired Tony Baxter to come up with Figment the Dragon for the Journey into Imagination.
Wow.
That brings us to the end of this week's episode of Looking at Lucasfilm. And in 2 weeks' time, when Brian and I regroup, we will have both
seen the movie
Dial of Destiny. And very, very much looking forward to this. And again, if anybody has any info out there about that, again, I love that. That story that Harrison Ford shared in October of 2008 about the original idea George had for Indy 5 that was crazy but great.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that as well. But in the meantime, Brian, until we regroup and record another podcast, where can the nice folks find you on social media?
Well, I'm still doing, what's the name of it? Twitter. Mm-hmm. And you can find me at Geek with Children, but children is spelled C-H-I-L-D-R-N. And, I'm going to, especially when I go to the Comic-Con, I'll be going to San Diego Comic-Con, I'll be putting a lot of stuff on Twitter and other stuff.
Oh, very cool.
Up there.
Very cool.
So, yeah.
Okay.
You're not going to go this year, are you? Because they're canceling everything.
I have been doing so much traveling lately. I mean, this past weekend, put 700 miles on the car driving down to Jersey.
Ooh,
for...
Wow.
Well, no, wait. Okay. The week prior to that, because I was doing the Dayton Disneyana thing, doing the time. In fact, I talked about Star Wars and the stuff in the Disney parks at one of my presentations there. But cool. Between running Nancy out to Kansas City, driving back to Dayton to do my presentations, driving back out to Kansas City to collect Nancy, driving up to Marceline to visit Walt's hometown, a boyhood home, and then home to New Hampshire, 4,250 miles on the car.
Jesus.
So...
Okay, well, I guess Hallmark will trump Comic-Con any day.
I have to stay home and work. But again, I will love to hear what you see there, and we will, you know, the great fodder for future looking at Lucasfilms. And
yeah.
Okay, speaking of social media, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media. And over on Facebook is Jim Hill Media News. Look forward to seeing you there. By the way, again, we got some other shows here we'd love you to check out. We have Disney Dish, which I do with Len Testa. We have Fine Tuning, which I drew with Drew Taylor, who, by the way, has his own wonderful Mission Impossible podcast, Light the Fuse, that he does with Charles Hood. We also have Marvelous Disney, which I do with Aaron Adams. Also has his own show, very much worth checking out, 32nd Street, which is about Madison Avenue and all the evil things they do to make us buy stuff. And speaking of buying stuff, if you like what you've been hearing here today, if you want to head over to Bandcamp and subscribe, that would be very, very helpful. And beyond that, if you could do Brian and I a favor, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and recommend the show you're listening to right now, Looking at Lucasfilm, that would be helpful. And I guess that's going to do it. Okay, we finally got one out the door. Well, thank you for listening tonight, folks.
Thank you.
No, really enjoyed hanging out for a while. So,
yeah.
All right, we will be back soon.